start now and thank everybody for coming. It's nice to see you all. We're back on track again after a little summer break on the Global Health Histories seminar series in collaboration with the Wellcome Trust Centre for the History of Medicine in London. And my good colleague and friend Sanjoy Pacharaya from there is here today. Come on in, Jane. It's up here. Oh, I forgot we're recording this. It's a really nice to see some familiar faces and one or two other people who I haven't seen before, but I'm very pleased. David, I'd like to just refer to you. David Benton is the chief executive, is that the correct title?
From the 1st of October.
From the 1st of October, David will be the chief executive of the International Council of Nursing. So it's very nice of you to find the time to come here.
Thank you.
One or two other people that I'd like to just mention. Socrates, if you don't know Socrates of Mitsios, historian in his own right, long-time senior officer at WHO, and the author of the soon-to-be-published History of the Third 10 Years of WHO, 1968 to 1977.
Plus Alma Ata.
Yeah, with an epilogue on Alma Ata. So otherwise, friends, I'm going to get started. It's a special pleasure for me to introduce the two visitors today. How to put it? Maybe a few of you know that I'm Scottish. and I was born in a small town halfway between Glasgow and Edinburgh. And, it so happens that Professor Crowther is living in Glasgow, and Miss McGran is in Edinburgh. And the interesting thing about that is that neither of them is Scottish, but they both have great taste and great judgment. I'd just like to say thank you very much, Najib, for coming. I'd like to just introduce the new director of the Knowledge Management and Sharing Department of WHO, Dr. Najib Al-Sobhaji. It's really nice of you to be able to come.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. So without further ado, I'm going to just say a word about Professor Crowther, who is a speaker. She's Senior Research Fellow at the University of Glasgow History of Medicine.
Yes.
Section. Mm-hmm. And a very well-published author. Her special interest is the social history of medicine in Britain from the 18th to the 20th century. And her co-presenter today, on my right, is Susan McGann, a very expert archivist and historian in the history of nursing, based at the Royal College of Nursing in Edinburgh. And I think the plan is that Anne will do the presentation per se, and Susan will join in when we get to the questions, which I know they're both eagerly looking forward to. So, can I introduce Anne to get the thing started? Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Thompson. It's a very great pleasure to be here, and thank you very much for coming. I have to say that not only are Susan and I not Scots, but neither of us are nurses either. I'm a historian, and Susan is an archivist. But we think that we, for that reason, we may speak in an unbuttoned way. So we hope that we may speak for nurses, but as it were, not from the professional background of nursing. Now, this paper draws on two separate sets of information. The first, in which I feel fairly at home, are the historical records of the Royal College of Nursing. I call it RCN, it's always known by that title in the UK, and the archives, as Thompson has said, in Edinburgh. I'm one of the three co-authors of its history, together with RCN archivist Susan McGann and Dr. Rona Dougal. And I think that most of you will know of the RCN, which is the largest organisation of nurses in Britain. It was founded in 1916, before nursing in Britain came under state regulation, and its aim was to, quote, promote the interest of nursing in all of its branches. Its first articles of association specifically said that it repudiated trade unionism, and it remained non-trade union until 1977, when it very reluctantly became a trade union, though not now affiliated to the British Trade Union Congress. It's always regarded itself as the defender of professional status of nurses in Britain and elsewhere, and its founders belonged to the British social elite, as seen in this picture, which is of the... this is a picture of the opening of the RCN College of Nursing headquarters. Those of you who know London may know the RCN headquarters. It's just behind Oxford Street, so very handy both for nursing and for shopping. It's a very, very grand building which used to belong to a prime minister and was bought for the college by a wealthy benefactor and presented to them and then rebuilt as offices. So it's still there and it's a very prime site. And I think I show you this picture not just for parochial reasons, but to illustrate the very elite status of the group that founded nursing, because the picture which has got the platform party at the opening, on the far right sitting down is the Minister of Health, Neville Chamberlain. And then there is the Archbishop of Canterbury. And then there is the Queen, Queen Mary, at that stage. And she's handing over the baton to Dame Sarah Swift, who was a chief nurse in the Red Cross during the First World War, ran the Red Cross nursing sector from England, and a lot of other elite personages. So it was a body that indicated that the Royal College of Nursing began with support from the highest quarters. It was a group with very, very distinguished patrons, and it could draw on the elite of society, because the kind of nurses who founded the RCN were elite nurses. They came from the highest social classes. So that is my first set of information, and why is this relevant? My second set of information comes from the detailed diaries, professional papers and oral reminiscences of a British nurse who spent most of her career working for the WHO in six countries in four separate WHO regions after the Second World War. She retired many years ago, and although I doubt that whether she'll be personally known to anyone present, I haven't yet got her permission to use her name, so I shall use the normal conventions of oral history, and I'll refer to her today as Nurse C. Nurse C's first posting was to a hospital in rural India, where she arrived full of idealism. She was a young woman. She said, "Because I am only too keenly aware of the debt that the British owe to India." She was a junior member of the WHO team at this stage, and her working and living conditions in rural India were a considerable cultural shock to her. For some weeks after she arrived, her diaries are very mournful. She kept a diary every day, very detailed. And her diaries are very mournful when she arrived in the rural hospital. In the evening, she consoled herself by reading Florence Nightingale's Notes on Nursing. And she reflected sadly on Florence Nightingale's views about ventilation. Florence Nightingale, of course, believed that you ought to have windows open all the time for ventilation and for health. And Nurse C couldn't open her windows because she was too terrified of rats. So she felt there was a big discrepancy between Nightingale's experience and her own. But she and her team leader and their national counterparts were determined to improve nurse training. That's what they'd been sent in to do. And they wanted also to improve conditions in the nurse's home. But one obstacle was the difficulty in attracting the attention of the medical superintendent of the hospital, who was also principal of its medical school. There were supposed to be regular meetings between the senior nursing staff and the senior medical staff to discuss policy, but the medical superintendent very rarely attended. Miss C's diary notes, "For the third time this week, I tried to see the medical superintendent, all to no avail. 4 days later, she managed to pin him down after seven attempts. This usually involved sitting in the corridor outside his office for several hours. Later, she went to another posting in an Indian city, where the principal of the medical school was slightly more accessible. The method of seeing him in this hospital was to wait in the corridor. You were actually given a chair to sit on, and everybody waited in a queue, and as a person was seen, a game of musical chairs occurred, so everybody moved up one. Though when Nurse C and her senior colleague, an Indian nurse, got to the head of the queue, they found themselves rudely pushed aside by the man behind them, who obviously didn't think that nurses should be in front of him. The principal admonished him and sent him back again and saw them and spoke to them. But it was Miss C was very much under the impression that had her Indian nursing colleague been in the queue alone, that this would not have happened. you couldn't so easily shove aside a British nurse who represented money from the WHO, but you could certainly push aside an Indian nurse who'd been waiting in a corridor for some hours. It was not good form, as it were, to treat the WHO in this state, but local nurses were another matter. In subsequent postings in Africa and in the Middle East, when Nurse C was in a more senior position, she found it easier to gain access to the medical authorities, but much less easy to convince them that the professional status of nurses was worthy of respect. Well, what is the link between these two stories? One is the foundation of a small but prestigious nursing organisation in London in 1916, and the experience of a junior WHO nurse in India many decades later. The link lies in the problematic and troubled status of the nursing profession. Our researchers into the history of the RCN exposed this question repeatedly, and on comparing the position of nurses in Britain with those in international bodies, not only in the WHO, but in the international health organisations that preceded it, I was very much struck by the way in which certain ideas about professionalism and status recur repeatedly over a long period of time and from one context to another. And so in this paper, what I want to do is to draw on our experiences of the history of the RCN and to compare them with our more limited information about international nursing, in hopes that the audience may be able to tell us more about what was happening and whether our assumptions are wrong, about the difficulties which nurses faced, which seem to spread from national to international nursing bodies. The historical literature on the history of nursing is full of anxiety about professional status. In 1977, Dr. Ada Jacox, then Associate Dean of Research in the Nursing School of the University of Colorado, wrote, "Nurses' view of themselves as a profession has not always coincided with other persons' definition of what has been meant by professional." She noted the distinction, long upheld by nurses in many countries, that whereas medicine was the science of cure, nursing was the science of care. This attitude, Dr. Jacox felt, did nurses no favours. Care was a term laden with gender significance, and virtually any textbook in the subject will comment, thereby devalued nursing both socially and economically. In addition, in most countries, patients will consider the person who looks after them at the bedside to be the nurse, regardless of the education or the training that that person has received. Whereas doctors have managed to secure their status by elaborate legal safeguards, in many countries, and by virtue of closing their profession through their education and examination. But nurse is a word that has been used in many contexts to describe many types of people with many types of training. And for these reasons, nursing has often been described as one of the insecure professions, less able to defend itself because of its scarcity value than the medical profession can do. Dr. Jacox's essay was entitled "An Underestimated Problem in Nursing: The Effect of the Economic and Social Welfare of Nurses on Patient Care." She was speaking internationally, and she drew a clear parallel between the social status of nurses and the standards of patient care. This anxiety about the professional status of nurses was widespread across many countries. Perhaps for this reason, nurses have always chosen one nurse to signify and symbolise their profession, because she is a nurse of high social status who symbolises the highest professional nursing standards. And this was, of course, the nurse whose work Nurse C was reading so dolefully in India when she joined the WHO. There is one nurse alone, I think, who is internationally recognised. And I thought the best way to exemplify this was by the stamps of the world. I could have chosen a good many more, but as you can see, Florence Nightingale appears in stamps from many, many countries. I'm sure if one had enough philatelic history, one could find pictures of Florence Nightingale practically everywhere. Whenever a country wishes to celebrate nursing by producing a stamp, it always seems to put Florence Nightingale on the stamp. So you get it not only in colonies which once belonged to Britain, in places which have a British tradition, but also in places which are outside the British influence but have still adopted Florence Nightingale as an international symbol of nursing. Another international symbol appears in the picture in the bottom right. You see the two nurses holding the lamp. And the lamp, too, has become an international symbol of nursing. The lamp signifies learning. It signifies that you hand on the lamp, the signal of nursing and learning, and it says nursing is a learned profession, not just a practical profession. So that, too, I think, is something that comments on the status of nursing, that one chooses the founder of nursing, as accepted in many countries, to have certain standards which must be internationally respected. And then also the lamp, which I think in the popular mind is also associated with the Nightingale, though the sort of lamp that is described, of course, is not the sort of lamp Nightingale carried, but the Nightingale and lamp come together in the popular mind, signifying the highest and best standards of nursing wherever you may be. And of course, as you'll well know, Florence Nightingale's birthday has also been adopted internationally as International Nurses Day. And in several countries, it's still associated with ceremonies involving ceremonial handing on of lamps. So the nurse, the lamp, that nurse, that lamp have become international currency. But many historians of nursing have pointed out Florence Nightingale is an ambiguous symbol. She certainly wished to elevate the status of nursing to a respected profession. And in Britain and in many other countries, her example was very successful in attracting women from higher social classes into nursing. At a time when nursing was not regarded as an attractive profession and when few professions were open to women. But Nightingale also believed that nursing was a vocation rather than a profession in the technical sense of the word. According to the popular definition of nursing vocation, good nurses are born, not made, and they dedicate their lives to their work not out of some kind of professional ambition, but out of commitment and altruism. This interpretation probably does little justice to the real views of Florence Nightingale, who certainly argued that nurses ought to be well paid for what they did. She didn't think they should be an underpaid profession. But, of course, in many countries, the vocational aspect was seized on as an excuse to pay nurses rather less, this particularly in the Western world, because they were seen as ladies who did it out of a sense of duty rather than needing money. And many of Nightingale's immediate followers in Britain were, of course, women from the kind of high status that I showed in my first picture, women who did not need a private income, and it was regarded that nursing need not perhaps be paid as well as certain other professions. So nursing in Britain became very divided between those who supported state registration, which required examination and professional standards, and what one might call the Nightingale faction, who did not believe in state examination and who believed that nursing was a vocation which was best learned by the bedside in the hospitals, did not need high levels of education, but could be learnt on the job. When the regulationists won the battle in Britain when the government set up a regulating body in 1919, but the minimal standards in Britain for becoming a registered nurse were kept deliberately low because of the generally low standard of women's education, and it was not possible to demand a high standard of formal education simply because so few women would have met that target. Much hospital nursing, mental health nursing, and health visiting in the community was done by women who were not registered and who had very little formal training. And this becomes a pattern in many countries, that you have registered nurses who have to pass examinations, but you have many other people calling themselves nurses, quite properly, because nursing is what they do, but their training can vary immensely from maybe 6 months to a year to 2 years, but they don't fulfill what is usually a 3 year or more level of standard to reach the standard of nursing registration. So nursing is, of course, a highly divided profession with many categories and many types of worker, and the Nightingale standard does not fit all. For a long time, the RCN accepted only as members women on the state register, so it excluded a very large number of nurses. After the Second World War, when most health workers in Britain became public employees, the RCN became more inclusive. It accepted men, horror of horrors, in 1960, so it had a male component after that. It accepted nursing students and nurses with a shorter training up to a certain level into its membership. It's therefore grown from around 40,000 members in 1939 to around 300,000 today, roughly half of all the registered nurses in the UK. Now, the development of professional nursing organisations in other countries follows a rather similar pattern in several Western European areas, some former colonial territories, and also in North America, though at different speeds. Registration comes at different times and takes in different levels of training. In some countries, they were part of the wider campaign for improving women's position in society, and in many countries the nursing campaign was also part of the suffragist movement. So women's rights and nursing campaigns tend to come closely together. The international notion of this movement was of course signalled in the foundation of the International Council of Nurses, and delighted that David Benton is here today, in 1899, which was dedicated to improving the professional standards of nursing, as it still is. And it predates the RCN in Britain, though it was founded by a British founder. And for many years, it had a very touchy relationship with the RCN for reasons too complicated even begin to go into, but they didn't get on very well. Though I can't resist perhaps putting in another British picture. This is Ethel Bedford Fenwick. On the right is the founder of the International Council of Nurses. And on the left, Dame Alicia Still. She was a very high-class British nurse and representing the RCN. They were off to an ICN Congress in 1929, and their body language kind of says it all. The two organisations were not friendly. So one of the other things that tends to characterise international nursing organisations is their constant splits, and I think many histories may also be written of this, but who am I to intrude on private grief? I will not venture into these rather difficult areas. From an early date, the International Council of Nurses had a political dimension, pressing for universal systems of nursing registration and also for the establishment of departments of nursing in national governments. It was very keen to infiltrate nursing into national policy. Although the ICN is often split by national disputes of its own, it nevertheless became the most authoritative voice in international nursing. And accordingly, it was granted official relationship with the WHO in 1948. Its leaders serve on several WHO expert committees, and its views are often cited in WHO nursing policy statements. In spite of early disagreements, the general viewpoints of the ICN and the more dynamic members of the Royal College of Nursing and the nursing section of the WHO are very similar. You find all kinds of very similar viewpoints being put forward by these three bodies. This is hardly surprising since the same women were all in all three of them. The two British nurses that I focus on Britain because I know it best, and I apologise to those of you who know the international picture better. Two British nurses prominent immediately after the war, Florence Udell, who was secretary to the RCN's organisation in Scotland, then served on the RCN Council and then became its president. She was the principal nurse in charge of the British section of the United Nations Rehabilitation and Relief Administration and a leading policymaker in economic wealth and welfare issues in the ICN. Olive Bagalay was a tutor on the RCN's International Public Health Course, the first secretary of the Florence International Foundation, by Florence Nightingale International Foundation. She was UNRWA's chief nursing officer in Greece, and then the first chief nursing officer of the WHO. So you see there's a certain overlap in interests here. I cite the British examples, but there are others, of course, such as Lyle Creelman, who was active in Canadian nursing organisations, then in UNRWA, and then the WHO. So certain nursing leaders in several countries tended to take part in all of these bodies, and I think this gives them a certain continuity of viewpoint. So my topic then becomes, I'll divide it for purposes of convenience into various types of argument. Firstly, the definition of a nurse and the definition of the nursing role. The long-standing pressure for professionalism in nursing, as reflected both by the ICN and in national bodies and like the RCN, had a very strong influence in the formative years of the WHO's nursing policy and on associated bodies within the United Nations. From its earliest days, the WHO was receiving advice on nursing, particularly from its expert nursing committees. The first, in 1950, had both Olive Bagalay and Florence Udell as members, and it made a series of statements which were repeated in one form or another over several decades. The WHO was interested, the RCN, I should say, had a long history of contact with the international nursing bodies because it had, in the interwar period, trained international nurses. It ran a public health nursing course for international nurses. This is one of the prospectus for it. It began being funded by the League of Red Cross Societies, and then the funding was taken over by the Florence Nightingale International Foundation. So this was run from London by a kind of consortium of the RCN and the Bedford College for Women, which is part of the University of London. So the RCN trained nurses for taking part in international activities, and many of these nurses went on to take an interest in the WHO and become part of its membership after the Second World War. These were some of the international nurses trained in London. They retained a very strong affection. The public health nursing course, on which Olive Bagalay was a tutor, was condemned by the Rockefeller Foundation for not being sufficiently academic. But my colleague Susan McGann, I think, has very rightly pointed out that the course was aimed at nurses who had very different levels of education. So it was no good aiming at academic nurses. They were not academic nurses. They'd been trained in many countries in different ways. So at this point, basically, they were trained in public health in a way which fitted them for going back to their own countries, and most of the women who took part in these organisations did indeed become leading leaders of nursing in their own countries throughout Western Europe and rather more scatteredly in the developing world, and you find their names in the histories of nursing in many countries. And they also tended to reform after the Second World War, and many of their views begin to inform what comes out of the WHO's expert committees. So back to the definitions of the nursing role. This is what the first WHO expert committee says. I put it up here for convenience, but I won't read it in too much detail. But nurses are needed in greater numbers than other categories of health workers because they have direct, individualized, and lasting contact with people, sick and well. In this sense, nurses are the final agents of health services. And the second statement, the stage of development, and I think this is the most important one, so I will stress it firmly. The stage of development of nursing varies greatly from culture to culture. It is limited by the development of medicine and public health. However, in countries where medicine is highly developed and nursing is not, the health status of the people does not reflect the advanced status of medicine. And I speak to an audience of experts, so you will have your own views about this. But this is a comment which has been made subsequently by many bodies in different contexts. But the expert nursing committee made the point very forcibly that the standard of nursing does not necessarily follow the standard of medicine. And the final point, that medical and public health authorities contend that the lack of nursing personnel hampers progress of practically all health programs. This was just after World War II. So absence of trained nurses was felt to be a particular problem for countries at this time. But the problem was to define a nurse. What was a nurse? Who was a nurse? The word nurse is taken for granted, but the nursing committee knew that you couldn't do that, or what his or her role should be. Internationally, nursing incorporated a very wide variety of personnel, from university-trained nurses in the USA and Canada to ward attendants or village midwives with a minimal of formal training in other countries. The high prestige of medicine is not mirrored by any comparable prestige for nursing. This is where the experiences of Nurse C in India are relevant, because she did not have the status of her medical colleagues. In post-war India, for example, doctors outnumbered trained nursing staff. There were many nurses, but very few with training, and the number of doctors was far greater than the numbers of trained nurses. The expert committee recognised that the standard of nursing was crucially dependent on the state of education for women in any given country, and that recruitment would always be impeded by the social status and relatively poor rewards offered to nurses. Even Western countries where nursing registration was firmly in place, it was difficult to estimate the numbers of practicing nurses. There was always a huge wastage. Few women remained nurses once they got married. This continued really until the 1960s in Western Europe. And the committee significantly described six main functions for nurses. The first was to carry out the therapeutic regime prescribed by the physicians. So the expert committee in the 1950s still saw the physician as dominant and the nurse as secondary. And it put community duties at the end of its six functions. So carrying out the word of the physician was the top function of the nurse. Acting independently as a community worker was not rated highly, not so highly. It was an important function, but not the first function. All of these views would have been very significant and increasingly relevant to nursing organisations nationally, like the RCN, even in Britain, where nursing had a fairly high social status and public esteem. There was a major shortage of nursing recruits after the war, and it was in the financial interests of government to rein in increases in nursing salary. One of the problems of becoming a public body, as most nurses did after 1948, was that whenever it was an attempt to increase nursing salaries, it put up the costs of the National Health Service in Britain immensely because there's so many nurses in the service, so even a small increase to their salaries was a huge cost to national taxation. So this produced a kind of catch-22 situation. Everyone respected nurses, but nobody wished to have taxes raised to put their wages up. So you have this kind of problem, which of course still continues to the present day. This is one of the many pressures which forced the RCN and indeed other nursing bodies to become trade unions in due course. They could not maintain themselves as purely professional organisations. Now, as you well know, better than I'm sure, the WHO's main focus shifted in the light of experience, further from hospital-based medicine and towards primary care. This shift, of course, is exemplified chiefly in the Declaration of Alma-Ata in 1978, which aimed at public health for all, alas, by the year 2000, to be achieved by emphasis on the primary healthcare team. In this team, nurses and midwives were to have a major part, since they were, as the expert committee had stressed, nearly a quarter of a century previously, in the front line of public health, of health education, and of family planning. In the year leading up to the Alma-Ata Declaration, a number of bodies met, and they discussed the position of nurses internationally. This was still felt to be very unsatisfactory in the national context. The International Labour Conference in 1977 devoted much attention to the status of the nurse. It stressed the need for fair remuneration for nurses, and came up with the following statement. National laws or regulations shall specify the requirements for the practice of nursing and limit that practice to persons who meet these requirements. So they're still rushing some kind of state regulation, still not universally recognised. But they were not following the role of a very severe level of registration, not knowledge, I'll explain in a minute. Measures should be taken to promote the participation of nursing personnel in the planning of nursing services and consultation with such personnel on decisions concerning them in a manner appropriate to national conditions. By this time, the International Labour Conference and the WHO's own committees were citing the definition of a nurse which had been laid down by the International Council of Nurses in 1975. The ICN had finally decided to provide a more flexible definition of nursing. Originally, like the RCN, the ICN took the view that only highly trained nurses should be members of their organisation. They wanted high level of training before registration could take place. But the ICN definition had become slightly more general by 1975. A nurse is a person who has completed a programme of basic nursing education and is qualified and authorised in his or her country to practice nursing. Basic Nursing in Education is a formally recognised programme of study which provides a broad and sound foundation for the practice of nursing and for post-basic education, which develops specific competency. The ICN envisaged the first level and second level nurses. The first level were the fully trained nurses who were prepared to undertake nursing specialties as well as general nursing. The second were nurses trained to a lesser level who would work under the direction of the first group. But I think the thing to point out about both these definitions, both this one and the previous one undertaken by the International Labour Organization, was that the definition should rest with local conditions. So they stress that, you know, it should be defined nationally what a nurse is. So registration and qualification will be as defined by local conditions. But there is still the hope that there will be a first level of nurses who will be highly trained and capable of organising a probably much larger body of nurses who are trained to a lesser standard, but nevertheless recognised by some kind of professional status. They should not be simply, as it were, taken in without adequate training. So training is necessary for all levels of nurse, though both the ICN and indeed the RCN in Britain had by this time decided there was no good arguing that all women or all men ought to have 3 years training. This was plainly not going to happen. Economics of nursing were against it. In any country where the state or indeed private bodies were responsible for the salaries of nurses, they were always going to go for a less highly paid option, and that invariably meant employing nurses with less than 3 years training. And the aim was to make sure that the nurses with a shorter training were up to an adequate standard. So yes, the aim was to have an ideal standard, perhaps for a university education, perhaps for a practical education lasting for a long period, but with the recognition that many nurses would not reach that particular level, but they must be regulated in some way. So this leads it very open. I think I have to say that it's quite different from the founding principles of the International Council of Nurses. It's moved a long way from Ethel Bedford Fenwick, that rather stiff-backed matron, disciple of Florence Nightingale, who would not have considered anyone a nurse who had trained for less than 3 years. So the ICN and the RCN had moved some distance from their original positions. But it has to be said that in many countries, the traditional nursing organisations, despite their apparent support for wider definitions of nursing and also for their support for public health nursing, which was central to the declaration of Alma Ata and to all these comments about the importance of the nurse in the community, that nevertheless the international and the national bodies did tend to be dominated by nurses with a hospital-based training. So there is a certain problem here that when it comes to the crunch, the elites of many of these nursing bodies do, as in the days of Florence Nightingale, come out of the great hospitals, the prestigious hospitals, the hospitals with highly specialised nurse training, the hospitals where the high-tech medicine is practised. And although everyone would say, yes, yes, we believe in public health nursing, public health nurses are in the front line, the community nurses of the utmost importance, not only in the developing world, but in the so-called developed world as well, that when it comes to basic policies, often the voice of the people representing the hospital nurse perhaps tends to be the most powerful. They tend to be the most highly trained and the most highly educated. And the RCN itself in Britain ran into many troubles over public health nurses. At one point, they threatened to break away because they felt that the RCN's view of nurse training was far too hospital-based and far too concentrated on high-tech hospital medicine, and that the public health nurses were not getting sufficient attention for their own training needs. So there was a rather fraught moment when the public health nurses were threatening to leave the Royal College of Nursing and form their own organisation. As I say, nursing history is fraught with splits. The RCN managed to overcome this, and it still includes a very powerful public health nursing component. But I would be interested in your views as to whether the public health nurses have managed to hold their own better in countries other than Britain, because my impression is that they always had a difficult time wherever they were in maintaining their status, not only against the medical profession, but against their sisters or brothers in the nursing profession who represented a more technical side of medicine. The second question is for nursing education. And the question of what constitutes appropriate education and training for nurses affects both national and international bodies and is central to their conception of professional status. From the RCN's earliest years, there was much division over appropriate education, which can be quite bluntly put as, should nurses be trained in the classroom or should they be trained in the hospital? Should they be trained at the bedside? Florence Nightingale, as I've said, believed that nurse education took place in the ward by the bedside. She believed that if you have nurses had to pass highfalutin examinations, that many people, women, she thought, would be excluded from nursing because they would not be suitable for examination and higher education. Yet, as you well know, the pressure in many countries has been to move nurse education into higher education and to make it a university discipline, or at least a discipline which takes place largely in nursing schools which are separate from the wards, or where the ward is only part of the nurse training. In this, the medical profession, I'm sure in most countries, but particularly in Britain, had very strong views. Speaking as a non-medical person who frequently consorts with doctors, my own experience is that if you mention nurse training to doctors, you will immediately start a very animated discussion. But rather than quoting some of my colleagues from the University of Glasgow, which would be embarrassing, I'm going to quote the Lancet editorial from 1946. Oh, I'm sorry, I seem to have jumped one here. What have I done? I beg your pardon, I've lost myself. I'll quote it verbally. For most patients, most of the time, nursing does not mean the more technical feats of the sister, the skilled dressing, the saline drip, or even the careful dosage with medicines. This is what a nurse should do. It means having his bed properly made, having his pillows well placed, hearing simple reassuring words at the right moment, getting a hot water bottle as soon as he wants it, being prepared deftly for an operation, being amused and stimulated at one moment, soothed and settled at another. The born nurse, the girl who does these things well, is extremely common, just as the maternal instinct is extremely common. And she may not necessarily be good at her books, though she often is. So the idea that the born nurse is a nice girl who stands and holds your, you know, takes your temperature and soothes you in bed, this is the kind of medical version of the nurse, which means that nurses really have to be trained in the ward, that they must not become too presumptuous, because of course at that stage they begin to challenge the terrain of the doctor, which is unthinkable. And the idea that somehow the good handmaiden is the perfect nurse. Now, as I said, this is a quotation from 1946, so we assume that the medical profession has moved on from those days. But I have to say, as I've said, in my consorting with doctors at the University of Glasgow, I'm not convinced that this has happened. Because basically, if they're asked what a good nurse consists of, they will always say, take them out of the universities, put them back in the wards. That is the way a nurse should be trained. So this debate rages on, and it's always good for an argument in any kind of medical gathering. Now, it was about this time in 1946 that our WHO field nurse, Nurse C, joined the profession. So she was trained in that kind of background. Her main task was to set up nurse training forces in different countries. And like all WHO plans, her work was based on an operational plan agreed between the WHO and the government health authorities of the host countries. But as her diary shows, she encountered much opposition from medical staff. In most cases, they had not been consulted about the plan ops of the WHO. They didn't know about it. They hadn't got a clue what was happening. It had been agreed at a higher level. So the hospital principals that she encountered were not party to these plans for nurse training, and in most cases disagreed with them most profoundly, which was the main reason why her life was difficult. Nursing, they argued, should be in the wards and not in the classroom, and they resented nurses being taken out of the wards and put into classrooms. And she found also that the senior hospital matrons in the hospitals in which she had to deal shared this view. When she went to a African hospital, she met where they were trying to incorporate nursing into the medical faculty, which is unusual even by today's standards. The dean, I quote her diary, she said, the dean said quite clearly that he didn't see the need for degrees for nurses. Miss N, the matron of the teaching hospital, spent 1 hour telling me the same thing, that our graduates will only want to sit at desks and push pens, unwilling to go to the villages. Miss N says that already she must kick her sisters off their bottoms. Her new graduates, when asked what they want to do, say they want to take the degree program. So obviously higher education corrupts the nurse. You must not allow the nurse to get into the university. So Nurse C had a difficult time. I think she was a woman of great charm and character, and by the time she left, the dean was eating out of her hand, as far as I can see. But she survived by force of personality, but she had a hard time for the first couple of years. And even though the government of the country concerned had agreed to this nursing program, the dean took a lot of convincing, but she talked him round. So many of the WHO nurses came from countries where their national nursing organisations had been carefully patrolling the boundaries between medicine and nursing, that difficult terrain. And although eventually successful in her terse tasks, Nurse C found it difficult to negotiate with the medical profession, who did not necessarily share her view of nursing. But as I say, there is nothing to distinguish the views of this African university from the views of the British medical profession, which are represented in The Lancet. So I think this is an international thing, not a national problem. She also found that the problem extended to the medical students because they were not willing to take care of part in what they considered menial nursing tasks. And she gave an example from an event in India. There'd been major flooding. Huge emergency relief programs had to be put into operation. The nurses had to stay up day and night to pack parcels of medicine and relief supplies to be helicoptered and airlifted into the stricken villages. And as she said, the medical students stood by. It was not their job to involve themselves in these lowly tasks, even though it was a national emergency. So she found this nursing medical boundary very difficult to cope with. But I think the boundary, although it is different in each country, it was a problem for each, and it gave its own problems. So I think I'll just finish by talking briefly about the final comment, the role of nurses, the education of nurses. The third one is nurses and policy. I've tried to argue that the long-standing anxieties about the professional status of nurses are closely associated to more general problems about the status of women and their education. Now, I fully appreciate that male nurses must also feature in this argument, but for most countries, women nurses have been a majority, and the argument has tended to develop from that. And these problems extend from the national to the international bodies. I shall end this comparison of national international concerns by commenting briefly on the demand made by the International Labour Conference, which closely echoes the ICN's resolution of 1933 that nurses be consulted in the making of health policy. British nurses did not have a place in the Ministry of Health, the government body, until 1941, because during the war the government found it useful to consult nurses, because of course nurses were a major part of the wartime programme. But after that, it's usually been argued by British historians that the government's nursing division subsequently had little power in the making of policy. This is contentious, but I can't say that I have detected much authority from the nurses in the making of health policy. And there is a very long and difficult struggle by the Royal College of Nursing to establish a foothold in health policy at the regional and local levels. The new National Health Service, which was regionally run, gave virtually no power to nurses. The bodies were run by lay administrators and by doctors. Nurses were very lucky to get a voice in any of the bodies. And the position became particularly difficult after the 1980s because the doctors were then replaced by lay managers. So in Britain, nurses had lost whatever little place they had and were pushed out of policy making. If they have a place, it's a very hard won place in local health policy decisions, and they're not well reflected at a national level either, though the RCN tries to make up for this by being a fairly powerful national body. So, as we've said, both the ICN and the WHO expert committees argued for a place for nurses in public health policy. This supportive attitude, which was expressed most forcibly in the late 1970s, round about the time of the declaration of Alma Ata, was not much use to Nurse C. By this stage, she had moved to the Pacific region. And just before the WHO announced this enormous commitment to primary nursing, she lost her job because of cutbacks, and the nurses were in the front line, so her job was removed. So the commitment to nursing did not seem to extend to maintaining the nursing presence at the same strength. in the Pacific region. She did get a post elsewhere, but it was not in the Pacific region, which she had greatly enjoyed working for in a senior position. So I'm told that even now, nursing representation in the WHO is somewhat restricted, but I'm certainly not brave enough to enter that area, which I'm not at home in, but I would be much more interested to hear what the audience has to say about it, and if they can correct me if I've made some wildly wrong assumptions in this paper. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And that was lovely, and I'm so glad that you managed to get so much in there and bring WHO's role into nursing and vice versa, and you even managed to get those magic words primary healthcare back into the discussion as well. You probably know, do you, that WHO right now is back into primary healthcare with a bang.
Again.
Yeah, so we'll see about that. I think it might be helpful for Anne and also for Susan if I could ask for, by a show of hands, any nurses or people with a nursing qualification in the room? Could you show, please? And could you, as I go, we'll go very quickly, just say the country in which you have a qualification.
Yeah, I'm from Japan.
Thank you.
UK. I'm from the Philippines.
Thank you.
UK.
UK.
Yes.
Iceland.
Keep your hands up if you haven't already. Huh? Iceland.
Philippines.
Anybody else? I haven't asked.
United States.
Yes.
UK,
anybody I didn't get? All right, gives you a sense a little bit, okay?
Very interesting.
I think it's been very made very clear by Anne that she would love to hear from you. So give experiences, ask questions, but let's get talking. Thank you very much. And Susan, would you be very willing to take part too? Just remain seated if you want, you too if you like.
Okay,
but
right.
The floor is open for comments and questions, please. And I'll take hands as I see them, the lady at the back.
Thank you so much for that really fascinating talk. It's so interesting to me on a personal level. I'm not a nurse, but I'm in the middle of a PhD looking at the nursing profession in India and from a sociological perspective. And I just got back 2 months ago from doing 7 months field work in India, where I talked to nurses working in the city of Bangalore. And my study is on exactly the profession of nursing and the formation of professional identity, through primarily looking at hospital-based nurses of two categories, BSc nurses, which receive 4 years university level training, and diploma nurses, so general nurses and midwives. And a lot of the things that you said in your talk are still very relevant to India. One of the big differences that I have found listening to you and in my own research, where I really am analyzing the professional status of nursing through the narratives of nurses, is this question around status of the nurse. Now, in India, traditionally, nursing was a very low status profession. And those who initially entered it, were generally Christian or Hindus of a low caste. And although that has changed a lot, certainly in the last 100 years, and I think a lot of that is also due to globalization and the opportunities offered by nursing abroad, I found through my research, and particularly talking to nurses, that the nursing profession has not been able to completely get rid of this negative imagery or the low status idea attached to nursing. Initially, it was because of the idea of pollution. You're touching bodily secretions, you're interacting with men, and so on. And that isn't as pervasive now, but it's more the fact that it sort of seems as it still has that kind of a low status sort of idea or parallel, although not bringing in that religious imagery. So, for example, nurses would say to me, when I tell people what I do, they say, well, you're just a nurse. Oh, you're a nurse. And, you know, even I was given a very interesting story of a woman on a train who responded to a medical emergency. She was a nurse. A doctor who was also asked to respond to the emergency refused. So she said, look, I'm a nurse. I can do it. And what happened was the passengers initially said, well, she shouldn't do it because she's a nurse. And she was able to it was a man who had a urinary catheter, it had to be released, otherwise his bladder would explode. And she knew exactly what to do. And so these kind of things that I kept hearing, and also this association between the negative imagery of the government nurse, that there was a very kind of a negative stereotype of this government nurse who sits there, does nothing, and shouts at people. So those who were in the government service try to distinguish themselves from that, and those in the private sector sort of elevated themselves as more elite nurses who were very different from this government stereotype. And then in terms of what the profession was like, the professional ideology, I think the big thing of nursing in India is that the profession is really suffering from a crisis of identity between those who want to look forward and improve nurse training and those who are looking backwards. And I don't want to say looking backwards at, say, Florence Nightingale in a negative sense, but looking at a golden age of nursing where Florence Nightingale really symbolized that era. And so this is the big tension I found. And there were a lot of very, very vibrant and really quite big debates. I went to some nursing conferences where there was back and forth between people talking about where are the old values and those talking about, well, what about our new values? I mean, the old values are the ones that are keeping us
down.
So just sorry to go on a lot, but just because it was so relevant to my own.
Okay, I'll just comment on that one. Yeah. That's absolutely fascinating. I thank you most for that comment. It really adds to what I thought I knew. But I think you're right to point to the extra dimension that I can't shoehorn all nations together. That would be totally ridiculous. But you point to one very important variable, which is the status of government versus private nursing. Because in Britain, it's the reverse. The private nurse has always been ploughing a lone furrow, usually employed by rather exploitative agencies. She may actually get rather well paid these days, but she usually doesn't have much status. Whereas the nurse sits at the top of a major hospital will get government employment, but she will be the highest status of nurse. So I think, again, the states will have a different configuration because you have so much private medicine and they even have very high status within the private sector. So that's sort of the government-private balance will also affect the situation very profoundly. So you're very right to point that out.
Let's take a few more questions and comments. John, please.
Thanks for that presentation. I thought that was excellent. I was quite interested in a couple of different things you said, and I'll ask one question and then run others. As theirs, but you mentioned the word scarcity in the context of salaries. And you said that because physicians had this scarcity around them, that added more value to their role. How would you see that might be changing, or would it be changing, by virtue of the fact that now nurses are a scarce commodity, not just in specific countries, but on a global basis? There's a huge change in terms of recruitment and issues about retention. What impact do you think that's having?
That's a very interesting question because in many countries, of course, more medics are being turned out than can be effectively employed. Though I suppose with the international migrations of trained medical personnel and the international recognition of medical qualifications, the doctor moves around more freely, whereas some nurses can move more easily than others and are to better positions or not. But I think you make a very interesting point because I'm talking pretty wildly, but it seems to me that governments tend to respond to nursing scarcity not by improving the status of nurses, but by lowering the standard of requirement so that you actually take on more and more people of less and less training. This certainly happened in Britain, that the healthcare worker who's now, I think, up 6 months training is now a valuable part of the hospital team. Don't get me, I'm not knocking the people that do this job. But just after the Second World War, the RCN was arguing against nurses who were trained for only 2 years. Now they're thinking about nurses who may have been trained for only 6 months. So, as I say, I think the tendency is, as costs get higher, and if the trained nurses in short supply, then the tendency will be to lower the standards, and this may be reflected in other countries as well.
I wonder if you could put the music off.
That'll stop.
Could it stop now?
Thank you for your very good presentation. Really, got a lot with the last point that you made is very important because this is happening worldwide, whereby there is much more of getting the nurse at the lower level, you will say, because much of the need is really in personal care, especially with an aging population.
Yes, indeed.
And this is now the problem of the professional nurses in the world. Again, to this date, nurses are still defining what nursing is. They never have been happy on a definition that has come out throughout the ages of nursing. So the question being raised now in many fora around the world is, where will the professional nurses be when they were all valued, when they were able to be able to give personal care, which is valued by people? So at the moment now, nursing is really looking at, especially as a especially nurse practitioner arena, where they find more satisfaction as a profession. But then that's part medicine.
Yes, quite. This is, again, a very interesting national series of differences, because my impression is that the nurse practitioner has always done much better in the United States, for example.
Exactly.
Only very, very slowly coming in Britain. I mean, nurse practitioners are slowly developing, but the idea of how far they should be allowed to go is fought over endlessly.
Exactly.
But again, one of the very interesting things that Nurse C came up with when she was working in the Pacific region was that she that was at the point where there was a tremendous lot of talk about barefoot doctors. And she met a large group from China, and it was quite an amusing account in her diary. She said, we had a great meeting with the Chinese delegation. I think at that stage they were only just sort of reforming their international relationships. And there was a great group of doctors, and it was all conducted through interpreters. So we had a very interesting discussion about policy and problems. And then we all got to have lunch, and they all spoke perfect English. So she was talking to the leader, and they had been going on about their barefoot doctors and how proud they were of their barefoot doctors. And many of the Western delegates were saying, yes, yes, we need to think more about, you know, these lower-trained doctors, these doctors who can get out there. They won't need all these years of expensive training. And the Chinese leader said to Nurse C, said, you know, we don't need barefoot doctors. What we need are more trained nurses, because at the end of the day, they were not all that much more expensive than the barefoot doctors, and they knew a heck of a lot more, and they had been trained for much longer, and they could cope with virtually more things than the barefoot doctors could cope with. So he thought that of course he was a highly skilled physician, but he thought that the barefoot doctor was a bit of a sort of inconsistency in the system, and that it was something becoming a political issue, whereas if you'd taken the nurse practitioner into account, you might have actually, as it were, got a better deal. I don't know if you'd agree with that, but that was the sort of view that she came up with. And this, she was pleased, of course, being a trained nurse, at this view from China. But
you know, there are many studies that compare the care of nurse practitioners and doctors, and the nurse practitioners always come out as a better care.
In the first line.
Mm-hmm.
Let's keep this going. There's a lady here, I think. Yes?
Yeah. Thank you very much. It's very interesting.
Sorry, perhaps you could say, I should have said, say who you are and where you're from.
My name is Ragna Haraldsdóttir, and I'm the Deputy Permanent Secretary of the Ministry of Health in Iceland. And I've been a government chief nurse there for over a decade now.
Mm-hmm.
So these issues that you have been bringing to our attention are very, very interesting to me. And some of it is, I must admit, a bit frustrating to see how the issues that the nursing community was dealing with like 50 years ago, they haven't really changed that much, some of them. But I would like to pick up from what Joan was mentioning about the scarcity of nurses and how that affects the way we work and how the reactions are on behalf of the healthcare authorities in different countries. You mentioned that one of the actions tend to be lowering the educational status, although there's a lot to indicate that that means much more dropout, much more inefficient way of working. But I would like to add another one, which is that in many, many countries, the reaction is also to not to let nurses run their own practice, but to get different kind of managers to run the nursing practice. And sometimes we hear things like you should get back to basic nursing rather than work in education, in administration, in policy making. And I have observed that so many nurses are very, very frustrated with this idea, because nurses in general also need the role models of those that are working in policy making, looking at nursing as a part of the whole healthcare system in any community.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, you were mentioning the role that nurses play or do not play to a great extent in policy making throughout the decades, and it's very interesting to me to see how slowly we are moving in that area as well, because we have all these examples of good results.
Thank you for that, Tapa. Let me just comment a little bit more. It seems obviously policy can be done at different levels in the hospital, in the region, in the community, in the state. So we're looking at all these different levels of policy that may vary from time to time. But well, Susan probably want to comment. There's a lot of double think in a way, because in Britain you get constantly the cry, bring back the matron. That is the powerful nurse that runs the hospital. If we hand back nursing to this powerful woman, all will be well. So at the same time, we must get nurses out of these administrative jobs, and we must get them back at the bedside. And you have views. Well, Susan and I actually differ profoundly over this, so she will want to say.
Oh, good. Let's hear from Susan.
I don't know. This myth and call you get from the media in Britain about bring back the matron, the golden age matron, I think it's largely a myth. I don't think there ever was a golden age matron. As Anne touched on there, when the NHS was introduced in 1948, the administrative structures excluded nursing, even the matrons. So that wasn't golden age of nursing. So when was it? Pre-NHS? Well, that wasn't a good time for nurses either. So when you actually try and pin down when was a good time for nursing policy, it wasn't there. So to me, it's just the media hyped that up. And I would agree with what you said about the policy. I mean, even in Britain, and I expect you would all think that nurses have made it in Britain and have already arrived. But even in Britain, they just crawl up a few steps towards policy making, and then some change in the legislation or the structure of the NHS, and they're out again. So it's a constant battle, which is why I think the same arguments and themes keep coming back.
David, and then the lady, I'm sorry, I don't know your name, but you'll be happy to.
I do think we shouldn't underestimate the whole issue of the role of women and gender issues. And there are, even today, we are seeing in a number of countries the devaluing of the education of the nurse compared to other disciplines. In my own country of Scotland, when I was there as the chief executive of the National Board, we actually commissioned a research study to look at the curriculum of the then, in quotes, diploma in nursing and the medical degree and the legal degree. And in terms of actually the academic level, nursing actually was in line with the legal profession, and the medical profession was actually lower. There was a lot of issues around regurgitating facts at that time, etc. So in terms of some of these issues, in Botswana, they have a nurse specialist program. The learning objectives have been imported directly from an American program, which is calibrated at the master's level. Yet in the university sector in Botswana, it is given at the baccalaureate credit level. So the whole issue of calibration, an international calibration of qualifications, is something that is being used to manipulate the level of the nursing profession. I think the other disadvantage that nursing has had is historically there hasn't been the facilities or the opportunity for nurses to network as effectively internationally, and where they have been able to do so through bodies like the International Council of Nursing. They have been able to learn from each other and then introduce change on that basis, whereas our medical colleagues historically have had a much longer history of going to various international conferences, etc., and therefore create some of those parallel arrangements. So I think the issue of gender, the issue of networking, the issue of calibration are elements that we clearly need to put on the table. And indeed, with some of the developments that are now occurring through the European Union issue in relation to the Bologna process, in terms of the Lisbon Agreement, and in terms of where the World Trade Organization is trying to get to, these are issues that will, over the next few years, become much higher on the agenda. And as professionals, whether we be nurses or not, we need to be mindful of that and input to the process.
Thank you. Thank you, the lady there, and then the lady in front next.
My name's Maggie. At the risk of, there's some degree of repetition here, but when I look back at the 1950s statement and I look back at recent statements here, I'm seeing a repetition of the same vision. And that is a concern, really. It's one of the concerns I've always had about nursing is that it tends to be very introspective, and there can be a lack of harmony between the different representational bodies.
that fragments our purpose and our vision. And the medical profession has never really suffered from that. And the other point I have is actually, where is the representation of nursing and midwifery? I mean, if you look at my role within WHO and my professional and policy influencing role in the number of positions I've had in countries, it is not as a nurse or as a midwife. It's always been under the umbrella of my postgraduate, I was a chief nurse at one time, under the umbrella of my postgraduate qualifications. And I think this in itself has a lot to say. You know, we are not representing ourselves as a professional, or being represented, I'm not saying this very well, but we're not being represented as a kind of professional organ. It's what else you've done in life which seems to matter more. And that, I think, even within WHO, and Jean can speak to how many nursing positions we have in WHO, within Geneva and elsewhere, and the number of nurses we have. And I think that speaks volumes.
Can I let the lady there who also indicated a question to have it in? And I will bring in Jean after that, if I may. Thanks.
I wanted to bring a slightly different lens on this because I'm actually a librarian here at the WHO Library. And I was listening to this entire, both the talk and then the after discussion, through the lens of, boy, I am hearing deja vu. Librarians do this as well. Again, it's a gender-based profession. And there's so many resonances. There's the, well, we should call ourselves something different because librarians are an outdated term, or we should not take care of actually checking in books for people because then people will think that's all librarians do when we're our true profession. And it, I mean, you could get into this forever, but what I was thinking of when, as I was doing this mental comparison, was there are activities that need to happen no matter what you call them. And if one separates oneself too much and says, well, that's now beneath me because I'm a professional, whatever my tasks are, who then takes care of those? And that goes to some of the scarcity comments that have come up. So, yes, maybe I should call myself an information professional.
I'd like to hear from Jean. And Jean, would you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about yourself?
Thank you. Thanks. My name is Jean Yan, Chief Scientist, Nursing and Midwifery here at WHO. And I would like to acknowledge Dr. Maglakas, who also serves as a Chief Scientist for Nursing and Midwifery. Worked with Dr. Maller through the golden years of Health for All.
Fantastic.
So she really worked so hard. And I know there are many challenges that we are facing through the years, but I would just want to pick up on your last statement in terms of where is WHO. And I tend to, you know, I would like to bridge it to where we are now. If you look at the UN organization, the only UN organization with a nursing midwifery office is WHO. UNICEF and other UN organizations hire nurses and midwives, but there's not a structure called the Nursing Midwifery Office. And this could be the efforts made by leaders in the past who've really been working so hard to make sure that nursing will be an active contributor and will play an active role in WHO's policies and program development. Also, would like to emphasize that there's a global advisory group of nurses and midwives made up of leaders all over the world selected not because not to represent their countries, but because of their expertise. There are 16 of them. They are here. They are the policy-making body, and they advise the Director General in terms of policies and programs that would really make sure that the care aspect will be, and the nursing aspect will be incorporated. There was a mention of how many or who are the nurses here, the nurses and midwives at WHO. Our Assistant Director General for Family Community Health is a nurse midwife. We have three WRs, heads of country offices of WHO, who are nurses, and they are in Iraq, Bangladesh, and Kenya. We have also ministers of health who are nurses, and they're increasing in number. There was a mention of chief nursing officers in relation to policies, making sure that nurses are actively engaged in policy making and formulation. In 2006, we had 40 chief nursing officers, leaders sitting in the Ministry of Health, participating actively in policy making and programming at the national level. In 2006, we doubled that. So it means that WHO really needs to work and support these leaders so that they will be able to really actively participate in the direction and the reform of their healthcare system. So we need leaders that really is not the purest nursing nurse who really, you know, is committed to the turf of nursing, but a leader who can really work with other members of the team, who's articulate enough and can really discuss and, you know, explain and move things along with the other key decision makers, that we're not just there for nursing and, you know, the specific task that is being assigned to nursing, but I think nursing succeeds more when we are able to really relate to a broader aspect and really communicate with other members of the team, and that we have more than, we can contribute more than just the procedures, the care, and the skills, and all that, but we have the critical thinking ability. We have WHO collaborating centers. It started during Dr. Maglata's time, 44 of them, going up to 50, 30 in the pipeline, and this was put together as a network to support the primary health care, the health for all. And all of them, from all six regions, are forming into a network and really working towards that primary health care. So we are able to come up now with a compendium of 38 cases in primary health care models that nurses have creatively and innovatively put together and have been very successful. And this is what we will be presenting in the renewed primary health care, where the nurses' contribution. I think we get more, people hear us more if we could demonstrate our contribution in the care and in the improvement of global health, rather than focusing on the nurses and nursing profession itself. Because through our work, people will know who are these nurses. They could be, we have now nurses who are not only ministers of health, but presidents of synods. Nurses who are leading in clinical area, nurses in research. So they're, you could see them all. So I think the issue here is to make sure that we acknowledge those and we capture those evidence and share them to as many health professions or as many individuals that we work with, so that they'll be aware as to the level of contribution and the sophistication and savvy that we have as nurses and midwives. And that together, if we work together, whether nurses or midwives, as a team, that we really can, you know, make this world better and really could measure it to improve health outcomes. So that's my report.
And it's on the
history, the history and the present, and that, you know, we still have a long ways to go with WHO, but through, you know, knowing all this and lessons learned and gaps and challenges, this moves us forward as shown by the, you know, efforts in the past and how we're able to, you know, move.
Can I say
forward
a little bit?
Yes, of course.
People are questioning that the nurses in WHO have declined so much. But we must remember that the world has changed. Things have changed. When WHO started out, way back in 1948, nurses were in the hundreds, all spread out in the countries of the world, especially Africa, Asia, Latin America, where there were no nursing schools. And many countries did not have nursing schools. So WHO, you would find a country, some six WHO nurses, because they taught everything, surgical nursing, psychiatric nursing, nursing arts, etc. At the same time, giving fellowships to all these countries so that they can have their own manpower to man their own schools. So if there's anything that WHO nursing and nurses have done in the world, is the development of schools of nursing for countries to have their own resources. Mm-hmm. Then the phasing out of all these six or five nurses in each of the countries, of course, dwindle the numbers. And then you find them only in some key positions to be able to help and sustain the development that has been done. And I'm glad you did mention, if doctors can be ministers, why not nurses? I mean, I've always said that. Why is it that nurses have to follow a very narrow line of what we call nursing that many people love, but they don't want to pay? So I think the problem is that nursing to this day is still struggling on the fight way back in the 50s. Mm-hmm. And you'll find WHO reports repeating over and over again. Look at the resolutions, nursing resolutions of WHO. It's all a lack of a policy-making role of nurses. But the chief nurses in many countries, they don't have them. Where there are chief nurses, they've been valued as co-designers of plans. But what profession doesn't fight for something? But where the status of women is not valued, nursing is not valued as well. In my own country, the Philippines, well, women have always been, you know, some people have said you are matriarchal, but I don't think so. The nurses are valued very highly, more than the doctors, that physicians are taking up nursing courses to be able to get out of the country.
We're almost out of time. Thank you very much. I know the gentleman at the end would like a comment, and he's been a regular attendee here, so I must let him, but we're almost out of time. And I would like our two guests to have a chance to respond. So could you give me a quick question?
Yes, thank you very much. Yes, I like the analysis, and really your methodology is very excellent, using historical records and diaries. I'm just listening to this from another perspective. I'm a social scientist in training, and listening to all the discussion, beginning from what she has said up to what she has presented, it appears we can maybe approach it using another perspective. For example, we are talking of power, we are talking about politics, we are talking about gatekeepers. There are those where the nurses are doing it, but there are other people who define who a nurse is, what the nurse should do. And I think maybe for Anne, your next paper in Lancet, you should write something like, I like the word prestige and professionalism, but you can put in something like the power dynamics and political economy of nursing, international nursing.
See if your head's been nodded in agreement there. All those in favor of an article in the Lancet?
In the Lancet, yeah.
I think we should give you a chance to come back and round it up if you would like.
She's been she, without her, nothing is possible, really. She's the gatekeeper to the nursing archives.
All right, my archives are open. The World College of Nursing Archives are open to anyone to use. And actually, on that area, just to clarify, the archives are based in Edinburgh, but they are the archives of the UK World College of Nursing. They moved from London to Edinburgh. Edinburgh. You would say that. To go back to the discussion, I would just quote a person I know, and David must know, Christine Hancock. Christine Hancock was the General Secretary of the Royal College of Nursing in the 1990s, and then she retired. She went on. Was she, what was her
president.
Role? Was she a chief nurse?
No, she's president.
President of the ICN. And when Anna and I were working on the history of the Royal College of Nursing, I interviewed Christine Hancock about the policy and the politics of the Royal College of Nursing and national government. And our discussion obviously went further into the problems of nursing and how they seem to be the same in all countries all over the world. And she said when she had done the role as president of the ICN and travelled all over the world visiting the countries of the membership of the ICN, she found that this problem in every country, that the status of nursing was always on the agenda. And she came to the conclusion that it was gender, it had to be gender. That was the only thing that was common among nursing in all the different countries. And I agree with that entirely. Even in Britain, where women have a fairly decent status, when you look at the historical perspective of nursing over 100 years in Britain, when the status of women is high, the status of nursing is high. When in the 1960s and 70s, nurses got the highest pay rises they ever got. when nurses, when women's status goes off the agenda, nursing goes off the agenda as well. So I'll just leave you with that. Personal opinion.
Yes, I go along with that. So I'm fascinated by the discussion because it opens up a number of new areas for me to think about. So I'm very grateful to all the participants. Thank you very much indeed. I think I do feel, in spite of Jean's very optimistic comments, I'm taking a pessimistic British view because we Brits are very pessimistic these days. It's part of the declining colonial power status, I think. What I see, just sort of looking in from the outside, is that the nurses did manage to get a place in central government. There was a chief nurse. There hasn't been now a chief nurse for 60-odd years. But the chief nurse has to fight with all the other personnel in the Ministry of Health, so she is only one of several power bases within the Ministry of Health. This gets back to the very pertinent comment about politics and economics of nursing, that they have this great fight internally about priorities, so she has to stand up for her section against a lot of other competing sections, some of whom are capable of shouting very loudly with the voice of the British Medical Association and other powerful bodies behind them. But even if she wins that battle, she hasn't won the war, because her ministry is actually not the most powerful ministry in the government. So unless the ministry can, having decided that nursing policy is going to be important, it then must convince the Treasury. And it then has to go to battle against the external ministries and the other ministries of state and all the other competing bodies within the cabinet. And at that point, nurses are not represented because, of course, as was rightly pointed out, the nurse may be the chief nurse in her ministry, but there is no one in the government who is a nurse. So she will move, the argument will move from a place where there is some representation to a place where there is none. And at that point, the nurses will be extremely lucky to make any headway. What we found in our own research is, funnily enough, was that the greatest support was the press. The Royal College of Nursing classically has never gone on strike. It now has the power to go on strike if it wants to. Its members have authorised its leaders to strike if they find it's necessary. They have never done so. They used to drive the other trade unions nuts because the other trade unions said the nurses are letting us down, they won't follow our industrial policies. So all the other hospital staff would be out on strike, the nurses wouldn't strike. This made them enormously popular with the public and also with the press. And with Rupert Murdoch, it's very important to have Rupert Murdoch on your side in Britain. So just at the time when all the other trade unions were at their lowest possible ebb, Mrs. Thatcher was brought into power on a great wave of hostility to the trade unions. The nurses were still riding high because of their non-unionisation policies, or the fact that they didn't behave like a conventional trade union. And just for once, they managed to occasionally make their voices heard because the press, including the very conservative press, would stand up for them, and the government would realise that they would antagonise powerful opponents in the media. If they being nasty to nurses was never an option, it was politically unsound to do that. So in a sense, nurses have had to rely on power structures which are beyond politics, and I don't think they've been able to do that everywhere. The British case has been quite I think significant, but I suspect it's fairly unique. And so in places where nurses don't have these backings, who will come to their support if they lose the power, if they lose the fight in Parliament? So there are so many levels of power. So yes, our last contributor was quite right. This whole thing must be put into a sociological and political framework of where do you stand within the power bastions of your organisation. And I'm sure this is true of universities and WHO and all the places that we work, that these things happen and we're used to them every day.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Anne and Susan. With your permission, can we put your presentation on our Global Health History's website?
Yes, though you might like me to just polish it before you make it go live.
Fine, but in due course, perhaps
yes,
it would be useful for people to know that's there.
I just wanted to add something that in WHO archives, so we do keep a lot of correspondence and documents from the really beginning of the WHO, 1946, between the relationship between the organization and the nurses, International Council of Nurses. A lot of correspondence of Creelman. So,
yes, well, I'm a very ignorant, monolingual person, so as long as it's in English, I shall have some funds to come and study it.
Yeah, it would be good. I just wanted to mention it.
We are out of time, and it's a pity, because I think we could have gone on with a bit more, but it's been fascinating to hear all these points of view, and the presentation itself is so nice. Thanks to everybody for coming. Thank you.